What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride.
Okay, here we are. Fancy meeting you here.
I'm sick.
Why are you sick? Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired, or are you actually sick?
No, like, I'm actually sick. The baby got me sick.
Oh.
She's been sick all week, and then now I'm sick. So I went to Starbucks, and I got that medicine ball. You know what I'm saying?
I have not had the one from Starbucks, but my sister-in-law brought me one from one of our local coffee shops.
Dude, it's so good. It's a miracle.
That's what I hear. A lot of people swear by it.
I do. I swear by it. And Phentermine. Not Phentermine. I mean, I swear by Phentermine too with the times I've been prescribed it. But no, the stuff that they make meth out of. Sudafed. Yeah, yeah. Sudafed's amazing.
Yeah, I'm an Advil cold and sinus prescriber. I prescribe to the Advil cold and sinus club.
Yeah. Do you guys want to hear a funny little story?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of my coworkers, her name's Megan, and she's like the sweetest, coolest person. And we've never met in person because we work in different regions. So we just meet on like regional Zoom calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her several, you know, a couple months ago that we were starting a podcast. And she was like, oh my gosh, like how cool. I'm gonna have to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so she texted me the other day and she was like, I don't know why I assumed that your podcast was about mental health. So nothing like me listening to your podcast, thinking it was about mental health, pulling up to work while eating a banana, listening to he molded a penis out of pork and put it next to his own penis to masturbate next to it.
Surprise, surprise.
And I said, oh my gosh, Megan, that's hilarious. I was like, oh boy, were you in for a surprise? And I was like, not the banana. And she was just like, no, it's great. And I'm glad you found another outlet to showcase your eloquence. So she was like, I love it. It was pretty funny.
I really love all the Megans of the world. I don't think I've met a bad Megan. I don't know. Part of me regrets that cannibal case being our very first podcast, because I'm always like, No, don't listen to the first one. Like, for the people who are like, what? He did what with pork? And I'm like, well, they're not all like that. So I guess it's half and half.
Do you know that scene from National Treasure when Nicolas Cage and Riley, his dude, they go into, what's her name's office? The Dr. Abigail Chase, Abigail Chase. And he was like, yeah, we think there's a map on the back of the Declaration of Independence. And she was like, okay. And he was like, it's invisible. And she was like, did Bigfoot steal it? And Riley's like, and that's where we lost the, you know, Department of Homeland Security.
Right.
That's how that cannibal episode is, because like Zach's buddies were like trying to support us when that came out. And like one of his friends, Eddie, was like, and I got to the penis eating part and that's where I had to stop.
And I just had to tap out. Just tap out. Well, good news and bad news. Or it's both bad news, or it's both good news. I don't know. However you want to look at it. But today we have another cannibal case.
I knew it was going to be a cannibal case because it's interview week and we've got the interview with Dr. Bill dropping after this one. And he is a zoologist who wrote a book about cannibalism. And so he's a cannibalism expert from a zoological standpoint. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, he was really cool. He does not touch on any of like the gruesome, you know, sensationalized. That really should, we should just have a sticker that says sensationalized, because I feel like we use that word a lot. But yeah, it was actually, I don't know if I've laughed harder in my adult life than him telling the story that you guys, I hope, enjoy as much as I did on this interview. Like, it is the wildest, wildest thing. But no, he was a great guy. It was really fun to interview him. But yeah, with that being said, we have a cannibal week, and I'm going to be doing the case. I'm going to be presenting a cannibal case.
Mostly because I'm sick and I couldn't do it. And Chelsea wanted to.
I did. And I decided to do a hard pass on all of the typical cannibal cases. So if you're really hoping for Dahmer, womp womp, we're not going to.
Or like the Donner Party or the Andes soccer team, football team or whatever.
Nope. We're not doing the Donner Party or the Andes soccer team. But this actually does take place in the Andes Mountains.
Oh.
So that is kind of cool. Hey, and then a weird thing. Did you know that Ed Kemper confessed to practicing cannibalistic acts with his victims, but then later recanted it? And he was like, yeah, I was actually trying to go for a insanity plea, but I'm not insane. So.
No, I didn't know that. I did not know that.
I didn't either. He popped up in one of my cannibal searches, and I was like, I didn't think that Ed Kemper was cannibalistic, but yeah, apparently.
I know he made his mother's decapitated head perform fellatio on him, but.
Yeah, the dude was super smart as well. He had like an IQ of like 145, but we'll digress. We're not going to be covering Kemper today. So, do we have any housekeeping? Oh, I did mail out stickers today, or not today, but I guess a couple of days ago. So awesome. Stickers are mailed out.
Yeah, our merch is available, stickers available for you guys if you want to go to our website and order some.
Yeah. My daughter flipped when she saw the holographic sticker. She was just like, this is so cool. She's like, I didn't even know you could make stickers that were holographic. And I was like, yeah, if Bailey can find it, then she will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let's hear it. I want to hear some cannibal shit.
I know. I think you're going to like it. It's kind of a sweet cannibalistic story.
I don't know how that works, but
I'm
here for it.
You'll understand why. You'll understand
okay.
why. So we're going to begin with a sigh because this gentleman's name is Jose Dorangel Vargas Gomez.
Okay.
And all of the articles, everything will refer to him as Jose Dorangel Vargas Gomez. But apparently...
Can we just call him Gomez, like off the Addams Family?
So apparently they misspelled his name, and it's supposed to be Jose Dorangel, not Dorangel Vargas Gomez, but he goes by Dorangel Vargas. So we're going to refer to him as Vargas. And that, my friend, is the beginning of this absolutely the hardest case I have ever tried to cover. Because I had to translate everything from Spanish into English. There's like zero English coverage on this dude. So here we go. Vargas was born May 14th, 1957 to poor farmers of Venezuela.
Ooh.
He was one of 10 children. His parents were known to work with the Venezuelan Liberation Forces patrolling the jungle borders with the guerrillas. And that's gorillas with a U-E, not the large land mammals.
Like guerrilla warfare.
Yes, but hey.
And not the band. Not the band, not the mammal.
No. Not gorillas with a Z at the end. Yes, like guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
So, according to the Cambridge Dictionary, a guerrilla, in the context of guerrilla warfare, is an unofficial military group that is trying to change the government by making sudden, unexpected attacks on the official army forces. So that kind of gives you an idea of what this dude grew up in.
Yeah.
In this specific case, this group was formed by the Communist Party of Venezuela revolting against the elected government officials, Rumalo Vantecourt and Raul Leoni. So that's who these people were revolting against. That's really neither here nor there, but again, just wanted to kind of give a background of the beginning of this guy's life. Like, he's born into this.
So there's war, there's communism, there's a lot of stuff going on.
And he is the child of poor farmers.
Yeah. Grew up in poverty.
Like, major.
Uh-huh.
His parents, like, the first information that we start getting about this dude is his parents claimed that Vargas was possessed by evil spirits. So they thought that he was possessed. But other than that, all accounts on any research that was done on his upbringing said that he was from a totally normal, abuse-free farming.
So other than growing up in like constant poverty warfare,
yeah,
with nine siblings,
yeah,
and you said he had some what? He was possessed by the demons and the devil.
Yeah,
everything was normal.
Yeah, yeah. Other than his parents thinking he was possessed by evil spirits, life was good, as Nacho Libre would say.
Get that corn out of my face.
Yeah. They were like, but life was good. Like, listening to these people that investigated him, it's hysterical. They were like, yeah.
Totally normal.
Totally normal. Can't be more normal than that.
Okay.
So some reports say that he didn't make it past third grade. Some say that he got all the way to sixth grade. But I think it's safe to say that he didn't get very far in the education department.
So he dropped out?
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, do you drop out? And if you're...
Or you just stop going to school? Yeah.
You know, I don't know, right? Like, there are a lot of gaps. So here comes journalist Sinar Alvarado. Now, Alvarado, he comes in after everything is said and done, kind of at the end of this story, right? And he was like, what the heck is going on? We need to investigate this. So he was really the first guy to kind of see this and say, hey, we need to bring attention to it. So he went out and he started doing his own investigative.
Is he a local journalist from Venezuela?
He's technically from Colombia, which is the neighboring country. But yes, he has worked in the Venezuelan and the Colombian news circuits, if you will.
Okay. Yeah.
So he would go on to write a book entitled Retrato de un Cannibal. Or Portrait of a Cannibal. So in the beginning stages of the investigation of this crime and this man, Alvarado traveled to the remote areas of the Andes Mountains. Again, kind of on that Colombia-Venezuelan border.
Okay.
During the interviews with Vargas's family, Alvarado reported that Vargas had become aggressive and violent in his teenage years. That's what the family was telling him. Like, he had a normal upbringing, he was fine. And then he starts getting aggressive and he starts getting violent in his teenage years.
Now, is this when they're saying he's possessed by the devil, or was he possessed by the devil? That's when they're saying everything's fine.
I mean, I think they just kind of were like, he was probably possessed by evil spirits. You know, like, we're not real sure. We just know that he was angry and he would leave for a period of time and he'd come back and he was like getting aggressive. So his dad stepped up and he would drive him into San Cristobal, which is the capital of Táchira. So Táchira is like the state within Venezuela. So
gotcha.
He would drive him into the capital, which is San Cristobal, which was not too far. And he would drop him off at a psychiatric hospital.
You know, it's really interesting because this was, what decade is this? Like, what year is this?
So at this point, we are probably in the, we're probably in the 80s.
Well, yeah.
We're probably in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times, most families in cultures outside of like Western United States,
yes,
don't really fully support mental health.
Correct.
Stuff. It's more, they think it's, you know, a battle between the heavens and hell, right? It's more religious in nature than it is mental health.
Right.
And so that makes sense why the families think that he's possessed rather than maybe
right.
he has
mythical
schizoaffective right. or schizophrenia or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. So he would take him into the psychiatric hospital there, and Vargas would be admitted. He would be medicated. He would be treated for a stint of time, right? A few days, a few weeks, usually not very long. And then the hospitals would deem him cured.
Yep. Yeah, he'd stabilize.
He would stabilize and they'd send him right back home.
And then he'd stop taking his meds.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And this went on for years, right? And they would call it, you know, he would have episodes or he would get into a crisis, you know, when the reporters were talking about this. And then they would take him, drive him back in and repeat the process. And like I said, this literally went on for years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually the family just kind of got to the point where they were like, you need to go. We can't manage you. We don't know what's going on. You need to go. And so he did. He eventually was essentially, I don't know if you want to say kicked out or disowned, but he was asked to leave.
Okay.
And he, of course, becomes transient. He is what they would call a vagabond. As Alvarado was quoted saying, he becomes a vagabond. And a vagabond passes very soon to a criminal. So Vargas travels to San Cristobal and begins living under an expressway bridge referred to as Autopista Liberada.
Uh-huh.
I'm really trying to be sensitive and not funny, but the dude literally morphs into like a bridge troll. Like, he lives under this bridge and he is just very, like, he's very aggressive and he's very violent and he's harassing people. Like, he'd run at people if they walked by him in his little bridge spot.
Yeah.
And then it kind of evolved into doing petty crime. Petty crime in the Venezuelan area was like chicken and cattle theft.
Mm-hmm.
So he was caught stealing chickens and caught trying to steal cattle. And he would eventually...
How do you steal a cow? Like, does he just bring it with him?
I guess when they're young enough, maybe when it's a baby.
Oh, like a calf.
A calf, maybe. I don't know. Maybe you just tie a rope to it and ask him to come with you. I'm not too privy in the...
Yeah.
In that department.
Stealing cows.
In the bovine department. So he ended up being arrested twice for theft. The timeline is weird, right? Because there's so many gaps in this. But at this point, we are kind of in the early 90s.
Okay.
So he's full grown, early 90s, living under the expressway. He's kind of has his little area under the bridge. And the members of the community start complaining that people are missing. You know, the police are kind of looking into stuff. There's just not a whole bunch of, I mean, any like any missing person's report. It's probably like, oh, they probably just ran away. You know, they'll be back in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Now it's 1995 and Vargas has been arrested for a third time, except this time the charges are cannibalistic murder.
That escalated quickly.
Escalated quite fast.
Hey, Gomez, last week it was chickens, dude. Now it's cannibalism.
It's a pretty big jump. Pretty big jump. So Vargas's first victim was a transient individual by the name of Baltazar Cruz Marino, whom he murdered and then ate.
Did he eat?
Yeah. I mean, that's what he did. He murdered him and then he
ate
him.
All of them?
Nope. He was very specific on the parts that he ate. So his case, you know, goes to a judge. The judge sends him to Santa Ana prison in that state of Taquaria for 2 years. But after 2 years in prison, his case is reopened and examined. And upon further review, they decide that, number one, they really don't have any hard evidence. They have no hard evidence that he committed the murder. And furthermore, in the country of Venezuela, if you are deemed mentally ill or if they suspect there's mental illness, then you are not allowed to be incarcerated.
So what happens to them?
Well, exactly. The judge orders that Vargas be released from the prison. The prison officials comply, but there was some paperwork missing in this court order. So they were not supposed to release him back on the streets. They were supposed to send him to a psychiatric hospital due to an apparent diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. But that paperwork didn't get there until Monday. So the orders went out on Friday. You know, the police official is like, all right, I guess you're free to go. And Vargas is like, cool, man. Thanks. And then come Monday, they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You didn't let that dude go, did you? And he was like, I mean, yeah, I did. And they're like, what? You should have waited. We had more paperwork.
Oh.
And he ends up back on the streets and by all accounts, just kind of walked around for about 2 years. So that was in 1997. So remember, 1995, he was convicted of cannibalistic murder. 1997, case comes up for review. They're like, oh yeah, this dude's schizophrenic. He can't be here in jail because that's not allowed. So we need to get him out. And they were like, okay, we got him out. And they were like, well, hold on. Did you send him to the psych hospital? And they're like, no, we just sent him out. We just let him go. And they're like, well, crap. So then some reports is he just kind of walked around for 2 years. Some reports said he walked around for about a year, but he ends up back under his same bridge.
Uh-huh.
He comes full circle and he ends up back under his little bridge and he builds himself a little homestead under the bridge. Okay, so he's putting down roots under the bridge, and he has, quote, a rustic house and an abandoned ranch. And it was in that ranch house that he would continue to victimize the locals, killing many of them and seasoning them so that they would be quite delicious.
So how many people did he kill and cannibalize?
Well, we're not really sure. So our first victim was our friend Baltazar. Our second victim was Manuel. And Manuel was actually a fellow prisoner when he was in jail. They did prison time together. And he was also a transient man. He killed Manuel and then proceeded to make delicious empanadas out of him and then serve him to all of his other transient and homeless friends. And when they went back and asked the transient and homeless community about this claim, they were like, oh yeah, he made the best empanadas. Vargas would go to say that he knew when he was asked like why he killed his friend Manuel. And he said, since he was such a nice person, he must be very tasty. And that was the reason why he killed him. He figured he would be very tasty and he would make great empanadas.
So how did he lure these people? Because I'm sure most people knew that he was kind of the dude who like hung out under this bridge.
Under the
and
bridge.
And they probably don't willingly just go there to chat with them, most of them.
No. So there was a kind of a path, if you will, from the local bars to the local neighborhoods. And you'd have to go under that bridge to get from the bars to the neighborhoods.
Oh.
So typically, he would hunt at night and he would attack unsuspecting people with a metal pipe more than a meter long. And he would also make like spears. He'd make his own little tools and he would just attack them. And then he would drag them back to his little house under the bridge and he would begin dismembering them. And he would save the parts that he would want to eat. And he would throw the hands, the feet, and the head into the woods.
Can I just tell you, one of the most traumatizing movie scenes was when I watched Jeepers Creepers. And he picks that dude, he pulls that cop, I think it was the cop one where he pulls his head off. And then he looks like he's kissing him and he pulls his tongue out and he starts eating it. That's all I thought.
I think
that's what flashed through my mind when you talked about him throwing the heads out.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've blocked that whole movie out because it was a little disturbing for me.
It's the 23rd summer. This summer.
I know.
Or spring.
I know.
23rd spring.
I know. And I really don't think I've watched that movie since it came out.
Yeah, I was just really traumatized when they killed Derry and then he could just see the holes in his head because he ate his eyes.
I just remember there being that rose tattoo and it was like, oh gosh, that's the dude. Because he had that weird rose tattoo like on
his belly button.
Like on his stomach. Uh-huh. Yeah, by his belly button. It was just traumatizing.
Okay, so he eats everything except the hands, the feet, and the head.
Correct. So people are going missing. And so relatives of these victims obviously start going to the police and start reporting all of these disappearances. The officers, however, could find no relationship between the victims, except that many were adult men. That was the only similarity is that they were all adult men. So, of course, the rumor mills get going and they were like, oh, it's like organ harvesting or it's satanic cult activities, right? I mean, people are just getting a bit into a frenzy. Well, the community finally is like in my mind, I'm almost envisioning when the villagers come in Beauty and the Beast, uh-huh. right? And they
kill
have like
the
their pitchforks
mm-hmm.
there. Yes, kill the beast. It's kind of like that. Like they are like, you know what? We're going to make our own search parties and we're just going to handle this stuff ourselves. And so they start going out into the areas around that river that goes by the bridge. And within a few hours, they find a foot
uh-huh.
and then a head and then more body parts that are kind of tucked into the grass or, you know, kind of hidden up on the bank of the river. So they go to the police again. And this time it's like, not only are these people missing, we are finding literal body parts in this area.
Yeah.
And so, of course, at this point, the police launch a massive investigation around that area where they're finding these dismembered bodies. It's almost like, you know, breadcrumb trails. And it eventually leads them to Vargas's little house that he had made. And inside his little house is stocked with pots and pans and jars of approximately 6 men.
Wow.
At this point, they're like, buddy, did you kill these men? Is that why you have these people in your house? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Why else? Duh. Why would you ask me that? So again, you have to remember the whole community is like taking this into their own hands on top of the police being involved. And the crowds are literally going ballistic and they are literally screaming to lynch him. And they are trying to come after this guy. The police are trying to keep them off of this guy. They handcuff Vargas and they transport him to the police station. And it is just social unrest. So as they continued their investigation, at first they thought it was about 6 victims. Come to find out, the body count got up to 11 or 12 victims.
Wow.
Over a 2-year span from 1997 to 1999. Word obviously, you know, spreads, and this thing becomes international news. The problem is Venezuela has never had this. This is the very first experience, not only with a serial killer, but now with a cannibalistic serial killer.
Who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and their laws are, from what I understand, you said, they can't be incarcerated if they have mental health issues.
They cannot be incarcerated. At this point, this is kind of where the interviews start with this Vargas man. And of course, people are, it's kind of, again, I'm using a lot of like imagery, but it's like you see in these paparazzi, like, you know, U.S. courthouse clips where it's like, Mr. Vargas, why'd you eat him? Why'd you eat him? You know, people are just bombarding. Mm-hmm. All the local news stations from other countries are starting to come in because they're hearing about it. And he is just being bombarded, you know, with all of these questions. And of course, the number one question is, did you eat these people? To which he very directly, very calmly, and really quite endearingly says, yes, of course. I've been eating people for 2 years because I had to.
Why? What were the voices telling him?
Well, he explained to them that he was actually a victim, and he was a victim to his stomach. His stomach was torturing him. I mean, Vargas was hungry.
Is that what he meant? Is like that he was hungry?
Yeah. Yeah. He was hungry.
He wasn't having any other reported like paranoia or hallucinations or delusions?
Not that he could communicate clearly.
Uh-huh.
But when he asked, he was like, I mean, I was starving. I was so hungry. So yeah, I ate and I had to keep eating. And he was like, I didn't have any place to keep them. They would go bad. And so I'd have to kill more.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I didn't have a refrigerator. I didn't have a deep freezer. You know, I think we have 3 freezers in our house. We are like the typical Southern family. We have multiple freezers stocked full of deer meat.
Yeah.
But Vargas didn't have that. And then not only that, but he would go on and he would explain to him, you know, how he would prepare the meat and the spices that he would use and the vegetables that he would use in different seasons. You know, he was like, oh, it's excellent when you make it with this type of herb. And then if tomatoes are in season, chef's kiss. So good. So then they asked him, did you ever kill or consume any women? And he was just appalled. He was appalled that they would ask him that. And he would say, absolutely not. They would ask him why. And he would say, because they don't bother anybody.
Interesting.
And that was his reason. And he would refer to him as flowers and gardens and pure and innocent. So no women, no children. He would also not consume elderly individuals. Because he felt that they were not nutritious and they were possibly contaminated and not healthy to consume.
Yeah.
He also did not consume anybody who was overweight for fear of...
Well, shit, I would have been real safe. We would have been friends.
I know. I mean, really.
He'd have been like, you're pure and you're a little overweight. Girl, I can't eat you. And I'd be like, well...
Like, in his reports, he kind of, like, he doesn't say these words, but it essentially was like, it's bad for your health. Like, the fat on them, essentially, like, it's a high cholesterol, high fat diet, and that's not healthy for you.
Yeah. All right.
So he was, like I said, he was very, very specific on who he victimized. He preferred very healthy, athletic men from the ages of like 30 to 40. He also preferred the thighs and the calves because they were the most nutritious and the most palatable to eat. He would use the tongues to make stew, and he would also include the eyeballs in that stew because of the nutritional value that it brought to the stew. However, like we had talked before, he did not eat the hands, the feet, the nose, or the ears because they're too tough, right? It's a lot of cartilage, and no testicles. Testicles were off.
I wonder why.
I don't know. He just said he didn't. He just said no testicles. That was not part of it. And then, like I said, the stuff that he didn't consume, he would bury or hide in the grass and throw in the river.
How did he lure these men? How did he bring them?
He would just attack them. He would be waiting for them. So he was actually quoted saying, if I saw a drunkard sleeping, so then that was the other part of it. Because again, the part of town that they were in, there were quite a few. There were homeless people. There were transient people.
Oh.
And it was close to the bars. So sometimes people would just pass out. If I saw a drunkard sleeping, I would kill him with my spear, cut off his head, and feel happy. I want to go back there and dig a big hole to bury them. I don't feel ashamed for anything. They have put me in jail for nothing.
Interesting. So there was no remorse, no... He really didn't think that what he was doing was bad.
Absolutely not. And that's kind of why I was like, it's kind of the sweetest, because he was just like, I was hungry. And this made me so happy to kill these people and cut the head off and consume them. And especially if they were, you know, like his friend Manuel, where he was like, he was such a nice guy. I knew that he would be super tasty.
Yeah.
He was very, very interesting.
You know, what's interesting about all this is, throughout this whole process, I've done some research on, like, the relationship between cannibalism and schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a lot of the cases that you hear about when there is cannibalism involved, a lot of the times there is some schizophrenia documented along with that. Because even our buddy Armin, right, he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially, like, schizophrenia with a mood disorder. And I think what I remember reading is that some scholars kind of have this theory that cannibalism is a kind of like self-defense mechanism or reaction to whatever their perceived threat is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be like their survival depends on, you know, the murder and consumption of another person or the assimilation. So like fitting in with them. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like for this guy that this was literally just kind of like him going to the grocery store mm-hmm. to buy a carton of eggs to feed himself. Like it was just kind of a normal thing.
It really was. And, you know, it's always weird the word choice to pick, the words to pick from to describe stuff like this. I'm like, is it fascinating? Is it interesting? Is it sobering? I don't know what word to use, but listening to these interviews with him, these reporters and these, you know, journalist would ask him like over and over, you know, kind of multiple different ways of, but you killed somebody, right? And every time he's just like, yeah, I was hungry, you know, and they're like, but you killed somebody. It was somebody's friend. It was somebody's son. And he just kept saying like, no, it's okay. I was hungry, you know?
Yeah.
So again, yeah, it really was. And so as reporter Anna Vaccarella, I really thought she quoted this beautifully. After spending a ton of time in interviewing him over the course of quite a few months, once that first arrest was made, you know, that initial arrest after they found all the bodies, the way she put it was he was a desperate man with a mental illness, unattended, and he acted accordingly.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty accurate, you know?
Yeah, because if you've never, you know, I used to work in a psych hospital, right?
Yeah.
And sorry for the sniffling of my nose, you guys. But I mean, if you've never been around somebody in their active episodes of schizophrenia or, you know, something along those lines, I think it's hard for people to comprehend, like, how could another human being do that to another human being? But, you know, I was in the middle of the psych hospital on Ward 3 praying with a woman to the God of the Wolves about the upcoming harvest. And so our species don't die in famine. You know what I mean? And that was her, that was so normal. And if you try to tell them outside of whatever their kind of paranoia or their delusions or hallucinations are, you know, if they believe that the Pope is in their vagina, you can't be like, the Pope's not in your vagina, sister girl. Yeah. And they're going to be like, well, then you're lying to me and you're with, you know, the FBI or the CIA.
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to, you know, stop my mission of, you know, ridding the world of cockroaches or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Like you, and that's, I mean, it tracks with this dude is he's just like, oh yeah, I was hungry. And people are trying to get this kind of moral reaction from him.
Right.
But in his mind and in his reality, because of his mental illness, there is no, he didn't cross any boundaries. It's like us saying that we picked up mushrooms from the grass because we were hungry.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting point that you make, because again, you have to remember that this literally was unchartered territory for all of the Venezuelan characters involved, right? This was the first for the police department. This is the first for journalists. Like they've never experienced anything like this. And they talked a lot about that in this documentary that I watched. One of them said, I would rather work with just straight criminals all day long as opposed to working with the mentally ill in regards to understanding those big questions of why and why did you keep doing it and why do you not feel bad about it? Because again, he just is like, he does not understand. Could not understand what the issue was. I mean, he said it himself. They have put me in this jail for nothing. And part of me, I know this is like so bleeding heart of me, but part of me is like, that poor guy, not only does he not understand why everybody's freaking out, he obviously understands that he's being punished and he doesn't understand why he's being punished.
Right.
You know, and I think that is true mental illness.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a tough one because I really understand both sides of it. You know, I understand that it's not okay to kill somebody, you know, because we don't do that as humans.
No.
And, you know, you want to get revenge or justice or whatever it is that you have. But then at the exact same, in the same breath, you have this guy who just doesn't understand.
No.
He doesn't have the capacity, especially if he's unmedicated, right? And this is the early 90s, mid 90s, right? And so it definitely isn't viewed the same way as it is in 2024, right?
Well, and that's literally what I'm like, you segued that perfectly, because this next section is the sentencing. So they look at the evidence. He obviously confesses. There's absolutely no, he's not trying to cover anything up.
He murdered these people. There's body parts in his house. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, and not ashamed of it. Not, he's not upset. He's not remorseful. Like, he's nothing.
Yeah.
And so the judge has to decide what to do with this individual at this point. Uh-huh. Again, this is 1999. And I think that Venezuela is considered to be a third world country. They do not have a lot of the amenities that even a place like the U.S. would have. And so they decided to sentence him to life in a police detention cell.
I think that Venezuela is considered a second world country.
Is it second world?
Yeah, they said that Venezuela is a second world country, but they also said considered third world politically, but first world economically.
Okay.
And there's like six orders of like third world. You have like first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth world, stuff like that.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I went down a rabbit hole a few years. I don't know if it was a few years ago. I don't know. Anyways, sorry. I just wanted to, I was curious about that.
But again, and that's kind of what I'll talk about here in just a second, but they decide to sentence him again to life in a detention cell because he can't be admitted into general population in a penitentiary, in a prison. You know what I mean? Like, he cannot be incarcerated. But at the time there in Venezuela, and it could be still to this day, mental health facilities don't have the resources to treat paranoid schizophrenia. They can diagnose it.
Sure.
But they don't have the resources to adequately treat it.
Yeah.
And the option was given to his family to, we will give him medication that we have, you know, medication that we know to be effective, but he'll have to go home with you guys. And they were like, no, absolutely not. Like, we don't know how to manage this.
That's true. I mean, it's so, families, even in first world countries with government provided resources are overwhelmed with having to babysit somebody with schizophrenia. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that.
Well, and maybe this is, I don't know, maybe this is too broad of a question, but do you feel, as a therapist, do you feel that schizophrenia is more challenging, just as challenging, less challenging to treat than other personality or mental illness disorders?
Oh, it's a tough one. I think you can do some pretty good work if the individual is appropriately medicated, and that can take months or years to get the right meds in the dosage.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also pretty resistant to that in general, and usually not in a malicious way, but
right.
You just kind of, it's like, think about women who takes their birth control. You forget to take your birth control. You know, it's kind of the same concept, but, you know, schizophrenia is tough because, you know, like, let's say if I'm working with somebody who has a substance use issue and they're an alcoholic, obviously they meet the criteria for being an alcoholic. They consider themselves a, quote, heavy drinker, right? They're not taking on that stigma of being an alcoholic. You put that person in a group for 45 days, you know, 3 hours a day for 45 days, and you have 12 people pointing out the flaws in your story. By the end of that, you can very well have the shattering of the denial, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With a schizophrenic, you know, somebody who's actively in their psychosis or their episodes, it doesn't matter who, you know. Jesus himself could come down from above, or the president of the United States could walk up and say, what you're experiencing is not real. Mm-hmm. And that just means that you're against them. You know, like, they're not going to believe you because it is real to them.
Right.
It's like me going up to any listener and being like, the sky's not blue. And you're like, yes, it is. And you're like, no, it's not. It's actually yellow. Then you're just going to think that I'm crazy.
Right? Yeah.
Because you believe that the sky is blue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's definitely a difficult. And on top of that, a lot of times they do abuse substances to cope with these emotions. And they're more susceptible to being victims of assault and abuse. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got trauma mixed in with it. And it's just, it really is. It's a very, very, very complicated diagnosis from that angle.
Well, and I wanted you to touch on that just a little bit, because I feel like schizophrenia is one of those words that holds a lot of weight. You know what I mean? Like, culturally, people are like, oh, they're schizo. Is he schizophrenic? You know what I mean? Like, that kind of seems to be this upper shelf. Oh, this mysterious, like, it's so bad. And, you know, it's just this damning, the worst case scenario. And that's where I was a little curious as to in the treatment of it. And again, where it falls on that, I guess I would say where it falls on that scale. Because I would imagine that schizophrenia would be very, very hard to work with. Again, like you said, having a husband who is a pharmacist and knowing that the medication alone is so tricky and it's extremely experimental, right? Like, meaning you don't know what combination will work for a particular person. So you take all of that in and with couple that with the fact that Venezuela did not have a exemplary public health system in the early 2000s. And so that's kind of where the debate came in these documentaries, is should he have been sentenced to life in a detention cell? And people are like, I mean, he needs help that we can't provide for him, but we cannot allow him to go back on the streets. Because again, he was, anytime he was asked, would you do this again? Would you eat somebody again? And he was like, sure, yeah. I was hungry.
Sure.
If I was hungry, absolutely I would.
Uh-huh.
So what do you do? What do you do for a population, somebody like Mr. Vargas? That's in between a rock and a hard spot. You know what I mean?
I mean, in a perfect world, you would have a nice psychiatric center with a, you know, leading medical psychiatrist who's well-versed in, you know, schizophrenia or severe mental health issues. You have staff that's been trained in mental health management and that kind of thing. But we're talking about, you know, Venezuela in, what, 2000, 1999?
Mm-hmm.
And the options are either return him to his family on medication, they won't take him. If you release him, he will reoffend. And so, you know, prison might have to be that option for him. At least there, he's not going to hurt other people and he'll be somewhat self-contained.
And I'm so glad. Oh, I just love you being my sister. Because there he won't hurt anybody else, right?
And he might not hurt himself too if you can do it the right way.
So let's fast forward to 2016. There is a jailhouse riot.
So wait, did he go to jail? Like, did he?
He's in the police station, in a
for 16 years.
Oh, for life. He has to be there for life.
I know, but I didn't know if we established that, because it was trial. It was in 2001. They didn't know where to put him, so they ended up putting him.
He was sentenced to life in a police detention cell because he can't be admitted into general population in prison, and the mental health facilities don't have the resources to treat paranoid schizophrenia.
I mean, that's probably the best place for him at the time, especially not being in the rest of the population.
Right. So we fast forward to 2016. There had been a month-long disturbance and siege at the overcrowded jail in the western city, western meaning western side of Venezuela, of San Cristobal. Because of overcrowding and because of like improper care or something like horrendous living conditions, right? Subpar living conditions, it starts a riot in this jail house. And there were about 40 prisoners. They're all in a riot, And Vargas, he breaks out as well. He's included in this rioting, and he then continues to brutally murder two of the convicts. They were strung up and they were bled out. And then Vargas reportedly dismembers the bodies, then feeds them to fellow prisoners.
Oh.
And the two victims were Anthony Correa and Juan Carlos Herrera, who were in there for kind of like
petty things.
Petty things.
Yeah. That's wild.
I have to say, as sweet as this man seems to be, I just don't think he can, I just don't think it's safe for the public for him to be released. And I hate that he's not receiving the treatment that he needs.
I think it's ignorant for any person to be like, well, they've got a mental health issue, they can't help it. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have to deal with the whole reality contextually of this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation is, yes, he had a bad hand genetically given to him, right? He had a shitty hand.
Right.
That he couldn't control. He was born into circumstances that he could not control. And I understand it does pull on your heartstrings. And at the same time, you cannot live in determined ignorance that this is not a dangerous human at the same time.
Exactly. When I was, researching this, of course, I get to this point where it's like, golly, I feel so bad. And then it's like, oh, and then by the way, in 2016, he brutally killed and then ate and also fed to the other inmates, or offered. I don't think any of them partook. But you're just like, oh, there it is. Ugh, there it is.
Well, and then we also do have to consider that, and I don't know what the research is. I don't know what any of that stuff is. But we do have to consider the possibility that this gentleman not only has schizophrenia, but he might also have psychopathy. He might also have, underdeveloped, gray matter and a larger, ventral, whatever it's called, whatever those structures are that are associated with psychopathy. He could be a little bit of both, He
right.
might be a psychopath, even if he is medicated on his meds. I don't think that's
true.
Out of the realm of possibility.
That is true. And again, one report was like, well, it was the riot that triggered this behavior. Because he felt unsafe and he was put under stress, it was the riot.
That's fair, too.
And that is fair. But
yeah.
Again, I would love to see a world where you're not going to have triggering or overly stimulating circumstances.
Yeah, and it's extra scary with this particular individual because, a trigger is more than just a psychotic episode. We're talking about killing and eating other human beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have to be extra cautious. Yeah.
So that is your case. We didn't have any platters of pork penises, but...
But we had jars of human body parts.
Male only, no testicle, eyeball stews.
It reminds me of Robin Hood, Men in Tights, when he goes to visit Latrine. And she was just like, I've got the hots for the sheriff of wanting him. And he was just like, if we got him really, really, really drunk.
Really drunk.
Latrine, that's an interesting name. Used to be Shithouse.
Used to be Shithouse. Oh, blood of a newt. Little bit more blood. I know. I don't know, man.
So what happened to him?
He's still there. He's just living his best life.
He's still at that place?
He's still at the place because they don't have anywhere to put him. And if I could have sworn that Venezuela was actually in like a crippling economic collapse a handful of years ago. I thought that there was some pretty big...
Listen, I am not an expert on Venezuela, so...
I was pretty sure that they had like a huge economic crisis, like food shortage, and it was pretty tumultuous. But all of that to say, I don't know what progress has been made as far as the public health department. What am I trying to say? The public health arena.
Uh-huh.
But it does not look as of today that they are able to adequately and efficiently treat Mr. Vargas. So he is still alive and well in his detention cell there in San Cristobal, Venezuela.
Oh, Mr. Vargas.
Oh, one more thing. He did just recently receive a Parkinson's disease diagnosis. But again, I mean, Parkinson's is another one of those like telltale signs. I mean, there's a lot of crazy research coming out on Parkinson's and other, you know, systemic factors and its connection to mental disorders and things like that. So all of these things are ticking the boxes of he just was dealt some crappy cards. But again, a lot of people have schizophrenia and a lot of people have psychopathy and they don't eat people. So why does he eat people? You know what I mean? That's what's another thing that's so bizarre. Why does he eat people?
I don't know, man.
And that's something that we talk about a lot where it's like, we're not saying that if you are schizophrenic, that you will become cannibalistic. And that was another thing that a lot of these reporters were saying, the ones who were like, we do not want him back on the streets, because they were like, look, a lot of people have mental illness, a lot of people have issues, and they don't make eyeball stews out of people.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know where this rant is coming from. Maybe it's from deep down in my soul. But the thing that frustrates me the most about these kind of situations or conversations is you have extreme worlds of thought, right? You have the bleeding hearts who are just like, we need to save everybody. And I get that. Cool. Yep. And then you have the people who are just like, take him out back and shoot him. Like, what's the point of having a human being like this in the world?
No.
And I think, you know, you can find negotiation on any ground, but I feel like people are so quick to just be like, oh, this poor guy, you know, he had such a hard life.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. But this, you know, this is coming from the world of working with sex offenders and pedophiles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of my sex offenders and pedophiles and psychopaths that I've worked with, diagnosable psychopaths and sociopaths that I've worked with, they had a lot of trauma. They had really shitty childhoods or genetic propensities to depression or whatever the case is. But that, and you can feel bad for that,
mm-hmm.
but you cannot let this, you know, your heartstrings be pulled into foolishness, right?
I think that's a perfect quote.
Don't let your
heartstrings be pulled into foolishness.
There was a gentleman that I worked with, and he was absolutely a psychopath, like some of the things that he did and said, and he knew it and I knew it. And during our course of treatment, we didn't do cognitive behavioral therapy because, you know, his emotional capacity to feel bad about things just wasn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we focused on was consequences. The only thing that would get him to change is he didn't want to lose his feeling of being in power and control.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we assimilate to society being a psychopath without doing all of these boundary violating behaviors? Well, you don't want to go to jail because you don't want to lose your freedom, not because you feel bad for hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we, you know, that was the approach that we took. But you guys, don't kid yourself. I was very careful with this human being.
Mm-hmm.
I changed all of my social media, right? After her, I think even while I was working with him. And he ended up finding me because he was a whiz when it came to computers and stuff. And he ended up finding me, and I moved out of state. This was 2 years later. I was working in a totally different place. And he ended up somehow getting a hold of my private practice cell phone. And he called me and was just like, hey, Miss Bailey. And I was like, I knew you'd find me. I knew you would.
Okay.
And I told him, I was just like, don't look up my house and don't come to my house because I will call the cops on you. And he just kind of laughed. He's like, no, Miss Bailey, you know I wouldn't do that. And I was like, we both know you would and you could.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, no, I respect you too much. I'm like, eh. Or it's too inconvenient for you right now. And I say all of that because I enjoyed this human being working with him. He was a pleasant man. He was fun to be around. He was charming. He was charismatic. He was all these things. But you cannot forget that people do not work the same way that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that it's the case with this guy. You get too bleeding heart around this, you know, schizophrenic, cannibalistic serial killer, and you can be like, oh, he had a hard time. Okay, well, you go sit in a cell with him off of his meds and see how he's going to appreciate you being a bleeding heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, he'll cook you and he will feed you to his friends because he is very, very generous. He would share his food all the time. And he took a lot of pride in the way that he prepared and cooked these people. But at the end of the day, he is a paranoid, schizophrenic, cannibalistic, serial killer.
Killer, yeah.
I'm sorry. And it's like, and he talks about the fact that he's like, oh, I pray and I want people to love me. Like he says really, really sweet, endearing, sweet little things. But again, you will end up in an empanada. He is a violent.
I just get frustrated with people. And this is where, you know, me having worked in the trenches for so long, seeing some pretty crazy stuff in my career. And I have a huge heart. I mean, anybody can vouch for that. I love loving. I love people. I love helping people. But I'm not stupid. And I've seen how quickly people can change and shift and throw you under the bus and become very nasty, vile creatures. And, you know, I get really tired of people being like, oh, well, you know, unless you have worked in the trenches, unless you've worked in psych hospitals, unless you've worked in rehabs, unless you've gotten threatened that you're going to be, you know, gang raped when you get off of work, or that you're going to be shot up in a drive-by because they don't like you. I mean, unless you've worked in this kind of stuff, I don't think people really understand how capable human beings are if they just have a bad day. You know what I mean? And so you can still be a kind, loving, wonderful human being and also, you know, not be in denial that this is a cannibalistic serial killer that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think I'll end it on quoting again Anna Vaccarella. He was a desperate man with a mental illness, unattended, and he acted accordingly.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Anywho, I hope you enjoyed this cannibalistic serial killer episode.
And stick around to listen to cannibalism from Dr. Bill's standpoint. It's actually really fascinating because
it's extremely fascinating.
Because he also talks about it from a human, development, evolvement kind of perspective.
He does. And he even has almost like a kind of an anthropological, kind of talks about from an anthropologist's standpoint.
Oh.
Culturally, you know, what is deemed culturally acceptable or societally acceptable. He has a couple of pretty cool stories about that. But I said, it was absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And he's so fun and funny. Like, he's a great entertainer. So not only will you get some great little chuckles, but you will be filled with just a wealth of information. So,
for sure.
Tune in on Friday. Until then, we hope that you all stay well. Grab a medicine ball for Bailey.
Yeah, please. Please.
Send it her way.
Yeah.
And we will catch you on
the flip side.
Bye, guys. Hey, Wildside Tribe, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast.
Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.